Welcome everyone. My name is John. I'm the president of the Campus for Christ, one of the clubs who's hosting this event. Tonight we're here for The Conflict, the third of a three-series campaign that has been running here at the University of Waterloo. Tonight's debate is being put on jointly by Campus for Christ and the Atheists, Agnostics, and Freethinkers Society of Waterloo. We want to thank both clubs for putting this debate on. So tonight we have an opportunity to talk about conflict, specifically differing answers to the question, should a 21st century scientist believe in God? With us this evening we have, on my right, Dr. Jeffrey Shallot from the University of Waterloo, and Kirk Dirksen. So this evening Kirk will be our theist. He is a theist. He's the director of the New Scholars Society. He has a Bachelor of Science in Physics as well as a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from the University of Manitoba. He also holds a Master's in Philosophy from the University of Manitoba, and he's currently engaged in PhD studies in computational biophysics at the University of Guelph. Dr. Shallot is a professor in computer science at the University of Waterloo. He got his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley in 1983. He has taught at the University of Chicago, the University of Bordeaux, and Dartmouth College. He is the co-author of two books and approximately 90 articles in the peer-reviewed literature. Some of his work involves debunking the false claims of the intelligent design movement, in particular, the pseudo-mathematics of William Dembski. Dr. Shallot was deposed in the recent Kitzmer versus Dover intelligent design case in Pennsylvania, but ended up not testifying because Dempsey backed out at the last moment. This evening, Ali Kanzarani from the UW Debate Society will be our moderator for this evening, and so I'd like to invite him up to get this show going. So, thanks, Ali.
Thank you, John. As John mentioned, I'm Ali Kazarani. I'll be your moderator tonight. I'd like to take a minute now to describe the format of this debate. To begin, each speaker will have 20 minutes to present his opening argument. Then each will be given a 10-minute period for rebuttal. And to conclude the formal debate portion of this event, each speaker will have 5 minutes for closing remarks. At this point, we will open the floor to questions from the audience. I will describe the question and answer period in more detail at the appropriate time. Before I call up our first speaker, a brief note about the nature and rules of this debate. First of all, we intend to have a scholarly debate tonight. Second, in the presentation of case, each speaker must make no mention of the other debater's points. That is, please, no head start on the rebuttal in the opening arguments. Finally, the timekeeper will be presenting time cards to each speaker, showing the time remaining to him. With 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute, and 30 seconds left, and finally a card reading stop when the speaker's time has been exhausted. I will only interrupt the speaker if he has either broken a rule of the debate or if he violates his time limit. With that, I would like to invite Kirk Dirksen to present his 20-minute opening argument.
Discussion with Dr. Shallot. Just by way of overview, there's two main ideas I want to present here. And the first idea is that it's a modern urban myth that each advance in science renders at least the Judeo-Christian God less necessary. And my second major idea would be that the advance of scientific knowledge serves to make belief in God more rational than it's ever been before. In order to understand where God intervenes in nature from a Judeo-Christian perspective, it's important to know what the three areas are. The first one is the origin of the cosmos and the laws of nature. That's one area that the Judeo-Christian God is credited with. The second area is the origin of biological life. And the third is the occasional miracle. And I say occasional because they really do seem to be rare and occasional. As you read through the Bible, you can go for 100 or 200 years without any miracles being mentioned. Unlike in the Greek scenario, where you would have miracles constantly all the time because the gods were always doing responsible for everything. So let's take a look at question number one and see if science has indeed squeezed God out of the explanation for the origin of the cosmos and the laws of nature themselves. First of all, it's important to realize that nature had a beginning. All the empirical evidence seems to support that. And when we say nature, we're talking about space-time, matter and energy, and the laws of nature, which are inseparable from the cosmos, from space-time. And even if we didn't have any empirical evidence for that, mathematics dictates that time itself would have had to have a beginning at some point in the past. Now that raises a question. If nature had a beginning, what caused nature to begin? What brought it into its existence? Now we have basically two options to consider here. Nature must be caused by either nature or non-natural causes, and I'm making that equivalent to supernatural causes. However, it's logically impossible for nature to cause itself to come into existence. That would be a circular argument where you assume the conclusion in your opening premise in order to derive your conclusion. In the same way, it's logically impossible for nature to bring itself into existence if, in fact, it does not yet exist. Therefore, nature must be logically ruled out as an explanation for what brought nature into existence, and we're left with the only other side of the true dichotomy, which is non-natural causes or supernatural causes. Logic requires, therefore, that nature, including space-time, matter, and energy, must have a non-natural and timeless cause. And why timeless? Because time itself had a beginning at some point in the past. Now, this is critical, because the question then comes up, well, if X caused space-time to come into existence, what caused X? Listen carefully. X must necessarily, logically, be able to exist independent of what it caused, to avoid the circularity problem, as I mentioned earlier. In other words, X exists in a timeless state. That's true for any X, God or any other X you want to put in there. Now, if you say, well, what caused X, and X exists in a timeless state, what you are assuming, really saying, is there was a time when X did not exist in this timeless state, and then it was caused to come into existence. But that's absurd. You cannot smuggle time into a timeless reference frame. In a timeless reference frame, for any X, it's either always there or never there. And the same holds true for a timeless Judeo-Christian God, if God exists in a timeless reference frame. Logic demands this for a scientist. In conclusion, I would argue that science has not squeezed God out as an explanation for the origin of the cosmos. Indeed, it's logically impossible for science to come up with an explanation if science is going to use natural explanations to explain the origin of nature. A non-natural, supernatural cause is logically entailed. So let's see how well it does on question number two, the second area that Judeo-Christian God is credited with. And that is the origin of biological life. And I want to focus on proteins here. Well, it turns out that science has not come up with a plausible scenario for the origin of biological life either. And I would refer you to this paper published in Cell Biology International 2004. And I want to point out that Jack Trevers is an atheist. This isn't a problem just that theist raises. It's a problem also raised by atheists. And what he argues is summarized in the bottom line on the screen up there. All known metabolism is cybernetic. That is, it is programmatically and algorithmically organized and controlled. And they go on in this paper and in subsequent papers to argue that it's really sophisticated software, that chance and necessity simply are too crude to be able to write. It's kind of like trying to build a laptop computer with a baseball bat. Now I want to use as an example proteins. Protein families. Think of a protein as a sequence of amino acids. It's a sequence where each site in that sequence has 20 different options. And if you get the right sequence, that will fold into a stable three-dimensional structure. Now these three-dimensional structures, the right sequences, are actually determined by physics, not biology. And so what biology must do is perform an evolutionary search in sequence space, and sequence space is a set of all possible sequences, to find those sequences that will code for a stable three-dimensional structure that is functional within biological life. If it is outside those areas, it codes for a non-folding sequence which is useless to a biological life. It's broken down and recycled. Before we can look at whether nature has the capabilities to produce a completely novel protein family, we need to know what the boundary conditions are. And it turns out that the maximum number of trials biological life has had is about 10 raised to the 41st power. What that means is all biological life that has ever lived and lives today has to be explained with only 10 to the 41 trials in the evolutionary search, if you're searching for these stable areas of proteins, stable folding sequence space. Maximum number of generations by this scenario between you and your parents and the first life form is 10 to the 14th. And of course, that's assuming a generation of 30 minutes. So I'm being a little generous here. That's the boundary conditions. Now here's the problem. If we just look at a component of a protein, which I'll refer to as a structural domain, which is a module of the larger protein, the best case scenario requires about 10 to the 64th trials. In other words, if you're searching sequence space to find an area that codes for a stable structural domain, you would only expect to find one approximately with a frequency of 1 in every 10 to the 64th searches, or trials, if you're putting together sequences. And I refer you to this paper here that goes on to more detail. However, recall, we only have 10 to the 41 trials to explain all of organic life, including the thousands of different protein families used by organic life. The number of trials required to find just one structural domain, which doesn't even code for an entire protein, exceeds that by 20 orders of magnitude. Now, you might get lucky on the first trial, because that's the way probability works. But keep in mind you need thousands of them, and it's going to average out to roughly one every 10 to the 64th trials you could expect to find or locate one of these within sequence space. You could look at it in terms of information. How much information would you need to find one of these stable areas within sequence space? And it turns out, if you use that figure there, roughly the step size is 200 bits of information. In other words, each selected for step is about 200 bits apart, or a little more actually. And there's no selective gradient between these ions within sequence space. In other words, there's no hill climbing, for those of you who are familiar with genetic algorithms. These are just mesas or plateaus that can rise up out of sequence space. The top of the plateau is where natural selection can work, because there are numerous sequences that code for the same structure. But once you get off that island into non-folding sequence space, it's useless to organic life, no phenotypic effect, natural selection is of no use. There is a simulation published in Nature a few years ago by Lenski that used small step sizes of 2, 4, 8, 16 bits. If you plug in 200-bit steps into that simulation, it will never, ever achieve anywhere close to the amount of information you're going to need to find a stable protein. No, you don't have to take Axe's word for it. It's actually relatively simple to actually check this out for yourself. The data is on the web now. You can download it for yourself. I'd recommend 1,000 aligned sequences just to make sure you've got an adequate sampling. It turns out, and I've got two examples here that I've chosen because they're average proteins as far as their length goes. The average protein is a sequence of roughly 300 amino acids. RecA and SecY are both universal proteins that occur in all known life forms. And for that reason, they're thought to be necessary for life and necessary requirements for the very first life form that ever existed on the planet. And when we do what I've suggested you do up here, to find the target space within overall sequence space, it turns out you could expect to encounter a sequence that will code for the RecA family about once in every 10 to 250 of trials. The first life form, of course, requires more than just a protein. An absolute minimum, it requires 150 of them. With the result that the probability of getting lucky 150 times is 10 raised to the minus 30,000th power. This is a serious problem. For a long time, people have been kind of burying their heads in the sand on this. But there are honest biologists actually saying something about this in the literature. Koonin is a Darwinist. If he were here tonight, he would strenuously object to this notion that God is anywhere responsible for biological life. But he's at least honest enough to say that we have a serious probability problem here. And his solution is to postulate that there are an infinite number of universes. And if there are an infinite number of universes, then it's almost inevitable that life will arise. I would strongly recommend you read the reviewer's comments. For a number of reasons, and this is they're available, freely available on the web. Some interesting statements, for example, made about intelligent design that'll tell you the real attitude towards that. But what I would really like to say is there's some other interesting statements there. One of the reviewers says most of science has the following features. First of all, it's got to be testable or refutable. Well, Kunin's many worlds hypothesis fails on that count. There's no way you can test or refute the existence of other universes. It has to be minimal. Again, it fails on that count because this is the exact opposite. We are postulating an infinite number of unseen, unprovable entities. And finally, it needs to be probable, and this is where all origin of life creative scenarios fail. They are fantastically improbable. What's also interesting in the reviewer's comments that none of them seriously contest this idea that we have a probability problem for all current origin of life scenarios. They don't seriously contest that. They suggest, you know, there might be scenarios where it's probable, although that still remains to be seen. A more rational explanation is that the distinguishing attribute of intelligence is the ability to produce significant amounts of functional information or meaningful information. And there's a way you can actually measure this in biopolymers. But this underlying assumption is also held, say, for example, in search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We have to have a method of distinguishing between those radio signals that come from natural processes or the natural operating system for the universe and those radio signals that might come from an intelligent civilization. And the key underlying factor here is a significant amount of information. Carl Sagan, for example, suggested that if they got a signal that had the first 100 prime numbers, then they could be confident that this came from an intelligent race somewhere out in space. But I want to point out to you that the amount of information to code the first 100 prime numbers is much less than the amount of information required to code for the average stable three-dimensional protein. So to be consistent here in science, if we're going to say that is an indicator of intelligence there, we have to say that is an indicator of intelligence over there. Same in forensic science. Underlying proposition to try and discern between whether that effect was caused through natural processes or some intelligent human being intervened in the situation and produced the effect. Natural processes themselves produce very only low-level information. There's a number of ways this could be researched, both computationally and in the lab. And I'm being generous when I say 50 bits here. There's some lab work being done at the University of Wisconsin suggests it's probably closer to 30 bits or less. But the average protein requires between 400 and 600 bits of functional information to locate, and we need thousands of different protein families. Intelligence can do this. We produce that kind of information all the time. We have a live empirical candidate on the table. Science has failed thus far to explain how the information for folded proteins became encoded within the genomes of life. This is not really a problem with science itself, it's a problem with the natural processes. They're just the wrong tool. Like a baseball bat is the wrong tool to build a laptop computer. But it is an empirical fact that an intelligent agency can easily produce functional information enough to fill up a 120 gig hard drive. I've done it, probably some of you have done it here. Question number three. Well then, how well has science done in explaining miracles? It's interesting. As you read through the Bible, I can put miracles into three major categories. The first one is prophecy, information about the future that would require a source that transcends time. That's all I'm going to say about that. I mention it merely for your own curiosity so that you can investigate that somewhere else at a later date. Then the most powerful, I believe, is a supernatural intervention into an individual's life. Probably the most powerful fact, when that happens, you know God exists, but it's also the most difficult to defend. Nevertheless, I'll just mention briefly an example of that, again, for you to think about. That has actually happened to me. My own first experience of God happened in nature. It seemed that God was everywhere, but yet infinitely separated from me. And about that time in my life, I was told, well, the reason God seems infinitely far from you is that you've committed moral violations that have established a barrier between you and God. They went on to tell me that God himself, in the past, had become a human being to take all the moral violations of humanity upon himself, to pay perfect justice for all those things so that we would not have to do that ourselves and that barrier could be removed. We had a relationship with God. It was explained at that point that if I wanted this, what I needed to do was to basically ask Jesus Christ to come into my life and take away the barrier that separates me from God and give me this relationship. I said no. I didn't trust God at that point. I was a bit afraid of him. However, I thought a lot about it over the subsequent weeks, and one night as I was laying in bed, I decided, wait a sec, If he loved me enough to do this for me, then I can trust him. So I just asked Jesus Christ to come into my life, take away the barrier of my own moral violations and separate me from God, give me that relationship with him. And that's when I began to first experience a supernatural intervention in my life. It started small and slow, grew more powerful over the years. And I would have to say at this point in my life that it is my relationship with God is the most intimate relationship I've ever experienced with anyone. And I have an excellent relationship with my wife, good relationships with my kids and my friends. But this goes far deeper. I'm aware of his presence with me throughout the day. I talk to God. He talks to me. Now that leaves you with something. I just close that aspect and say, it is by far the most fulfilling thing I've ever experienced. So you got three choices. Number one, I'm telling a lie to get my point across. But I can tell you, if I was lying about that, there's no way I'd be here tonight. I got better things to do with my time. I could be insane, and that's a live option. And I'll leave it up to Dr. Schall here to choose between I'm insane or I'm telling the truth. He doesn't even have to address this. I just toss this up because, as I said before, and I admit this, all you're hearing is me telling you this. You have no reason to believe it's true. It's the most difficult one to defend. But let me move on to the final one, and that's physical miracles. I'll give you a couple of examples. I was raised on a beef farm out west, and we had this one bull, very hard to handle. The only way we could do it was to put a steel ring or a snap ring through a ring in his nose and lead him around. One day I went to lead him to water, and I untied him first before putting the snap ring in the ring in his nose. And he immediately turned around and began to walk out of the stall. I knew that as soon as he gets his head out of that stall and he sees the cattle in the corral, he's going to destroy the corral to get through to the cattle. He's going to start breeding. I tried to hold him back with all my strength. He weighs 2,000 pounds, and at the time I only weighed 180. The rope was just burning through my hands. There's nothing I could do. And when there was this much left, I yelled, "God help me." Instantly, the bull was anchored. 2,000 pounds versus 180. I didn't feel any stronger, and I don't think it was anything to do with me. If I had turned into solid steel, he could still drag me away. It seemed as if there was something on the rope between me and the bull, but I couldn't see anything, and I stood there incredulous, just savoring the moment. I'd never seen anything like this before. I have no scientific explanation for what happened. I've thought about it a lot over the years. Example number two. My oldest sister, her girls had some pet rabbits. And one morning they came in and the two rabbits were dead in the cage, and they'd been dead so long that they were cold and rigor mortis had set in. They were stiff as a board. You could lift them, you know, you could lift it up by the back leg and use it as a pointer. And they're obviously dead. So the little girl said, "Why don't we pray and ask God to make these come alive again?" My sister doesn't know really what to do. This is, you know, kind of bad situation here. And she says, "Okay." The girls pray, and then one of them says, "I think God wants to do this in private. So let's put the rabbits back in their cage." They put them back in the cage, still stone dead. Go out of the room, and they wait for quite some time, and then they come back in. Both rabbits are perfectly fine hopping around their cage, and they live the normal rabbit's lifespan from that point on. Again, I have no explanation as to why two rabbits suffering rigor mortis will suddenly come back to life simply because two little girls asked God to make it happen. There's another one you can check out. Charles Templeton, well-known agnostic. I'd recommend you read that. And the reason I say that, it's in his autobiography, and it's coming from the lips of an agnostic. In summary, science has thus far failed to squeeze God out for the origin of the cosmos, the origin of at least the protein families, which are required for the origin of life, and physical miracles. And the cause of nature, as I've seen, must logically be non-natural or supernatural. The cause of life must be capable of producing functional instructions, writing sophisticated code, in other words, it must be intelligent, and the rare physical miracles, and they are rare, upon request, imply a being that's capable of relating to us. And so I conclude that it is still rational for a 21st century scientist to believe in God.
Thanks, Kurt. Jeffrey Scheller. I'd now like to invite you to make your 20-minute opening argument.
Okay, I've titled my presentation, "Are There Good Reasons for a Scientist to Believe in Supernatural Beings?" I did that because I think the Christian God is just one example of many possible supernatural beings, angels, devils, other sorts of things that we're often asked to accept without much evidence. So Stephen Jay Gould would say that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria. They address different spheres of interest in people's lives. So he's more of an accommodationist. He was more of an accommodationist than I am, because my answer is no, we shouldn't, as scientists, believe in supernatural beings. And why? Because it's undesirable to believe a proposition when there is no ground whatever for supposing it true, after Bertrand Russell. So whether or not we should or shouldn't, the fact is that most scientists don't believe in the Christian God. According to a 1996 study by Larson and Wibham, only about 39% of all scientists express belief in a personal God. And general population belief in a personal God is much higher than that. Now, when we go to the very top scientists, the scientists that are members of, say, the National Academy of Sciences, the figure becomes even smaller. Only about 7% of members of the National Academy of Sciences express belief in a personal God. Now, why aren't most scientists religious? There must be some reason behind it. You know, I'd say the answer is because science and religion are irreconcilable. So let's compare them and see why they're irreconcilable. Science is evidence-based. When you make a claim, you have to provide evidence for your claim. Religion, on the other hand, stresses revelation and dogma over reason and evidence. In science, no authority is sacred. I recently read an article by a creationist in which they said, evolutionary biologists say, Darwin said it, I believe it, and that settles it. Well, it's absurd. We know that Darwin made mistakes. For example, Darwin believed, at least part of the time, in the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which we don't accept anymore as a valid theory of evolution. But Darwin's not sacred. Darwin made mistakes. No authority is sacred in science. But in religion, and now I'm going to just stick to the Christian religion, the Bible is supreme. In science, explanations are always subject to revision. Explanations are tentative. If a new theory comes along tomorrow, we revise our current theory. Newtonian mechanics was revised and replaced by Einsteinian relativity. In religion, God's authority is unchanging and eternal. If you don't like it, tough. Science, emphasis on testing and experiments. In religion, though, the claims of religion are often untestable, or in organized religion, there's a strong resistance to testing some of the claims. So let's look at an example. Let's look at evidence versus revelation in the age of the earth. Okay, now science, what do we know? We know the earth is very old because of multiple independent lines of evidence. Radiometric dating, that's dating from radioisotopes of Earth's oldest rocks, rocks from the moon, meteorites, they all suggest the same approximate age. The degree of concordance for these independent pieces of evidence is absolutely astonishing, and they all converge on an age of approximately 4.6 billion years. Now let's look at one of the world's most famous creation scientists, in quotes, and see what he says. Henry Morris, he says, the only way that we can determine the true age of the earth is for God to tell us what it is. And since he has told us very plainly in the Holy Scriptures that it is several thousand years of age and no more, that ought to settle all basic questions of terrestrial chronology. In science, we have provisional explanations. Explanations are always capable of being revised. You may think the Earth is a sphere. Somebody might come along tomorrow and say, no, the Earth is not a sphere, not even a geoid. It's all optical illusion by some strange refraction of light. The Earth is actually shaped like a tetrahedron. And, well, if you can provide evidence, or she can provide evidence, great. So Richard Dawkins tells a story. He says, every Monday afternoon, it was the custom for the whole department to listen to a research talk by a visiting lecturer. One Monday, the visitor was an American cell biologist who presented completely convincing evidence that the Golgi apparatus was real. At the end of the lecture, the old scientist, this is somebody who had maintained the opposite for many years, strode to the front of the hall, shook the American by the hand, and said with passion, My dear fellow, I wish to thank you. I have been wrong these 15 years. You can laugh at the accent. We clapped our hands red, said Richard Dawkins. No fundamentalist could ever say that. And let's contrast this with Henry Morris again. The only Bible-honoring conclusion, says Morris, is of course that Genesis 1-2 is actual historical truth, regardless of any scientific or chronological problems thereby entailed. Science is based on evidence, it's not based on authority. J.B.S. Haldane, one of the most famous biologists, he was asked, what would constitute evidence against evolution? And he said, fossil rabbits in the Precambrian. So the Precambrian is one of the earliest places where we find life, the Bendian period. They've never been found. Nothing like that has ever been found. Evolution could be disproved by such facts. But there's that bumper sticker again. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. Now, how about testing hypotheses? Scientific claims must be testable. We must, in principle, be able to envision a set of observations that would render them false. But in religion, in Deuteronomy, we're told you're not allowed to test God. And let's look at another religion, probably a religion that most of you don't share, Christian Science. It's a fairly old religion. There are some very famous adherents of it in the Waterloo region. Probably the most wealthy man in the Waterloo region believes in Christian Science. And Christian Science believes in miraculous healing, in healing through the power of prayer. And they have testimony where thousands of these are given. But they absolutely refuse to do any kind of testing. They did one study, but the study said, we don't provide comparative cure or mortality rates, nor do we consider cases in which healing prayer has not been effective. So how is that a test? You have to test it against some null hypothesis. Okay, well, the Genesis account, that's the account in the Bible that tells how the earth was created, it's irreconcilable with science. So this is based on a creationist website, Answers in Genesis. You're probably familiar with them. And they're trying to show that science is wrong. They're saying, look, science says sun was created before, the sun came into existence before the earth. How silly. Genesis says the earth came before the sun. And they give a list of reasons. These reasons are intended to show you that the Bible is correct. Right? That there was atmosphere before the sea. Ridiculous. Of course there was sea before atmosphere. That there was sun before light on earth. Ridiculous. There was light on earth before the sun. Where, I don't know where it came from, but Answers in Genesis is sure about it. Now, why aren't most scientists religious? Well, a few more reasons. Let's contrast. In science, explanations are fruitful. When you make an explanation, it leads to other explanations, to new questions. It leads to unifying different areas that were different before, that seemed unrelated before. Now we unify them together under one rubric. In religion, the answer is always, God did it. Well, that's not fruitful. I could say that about anything. You know, why are rainbows occurring? God did it. Why are there earthquakes? God did it. Why is there lightning? God did it. It's not a fruitful explanation. It doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't tell you, you know, if I say, okay, why are there rainbows? God did it. It doesn't tell me anything about under what conditions I would expect rainbows, or what kind of different rainbows could form, or would there be rainbows on other planets, or under what optical conditions might you get multiple rainbows. None of those are answered. Another reason is that science is open to all, religious and non-religious alike. There really is a brotherhood and sisterhood of scientists. Nobody asks, when somebody comes to work with me, I don't ask them their religion. I don't make them sign a statement of faith. Stephen Jay Gould, one of the most famous paleontologists in the United States, he worked with Kurt Wise, a creationist, a man who believes that the earth is 6,000 years old. He supervised Kurt Wise for his PhD. He didn't ask him, are you a creationist? Oh, I'm not going to supervise you then. He supervised them now. Kurt Wise succeeded in getting his PhD. I don't know how he did it, because he couldn't have believed many of the things he was saying, but he did. That's the nature of science. Religion, though, divides along sectarian lines. That's the nature of religion. Kirk will say his religion is the true one. All others are false. I think that's a fair summary of your views. Isn't that true?
I'd like to expand.
Okay. Oh, you'll get your chance. In science, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So, what could be more extraordinary than a potentially infinite supernatural being that knows everything, creates everything, and yet we can't see anywhere? We can't measure, we can't take a picture of, we can't, at least I can't, talk to. Some others may differ. You know, you have to have an incredible amount of evidence for that. You can't just accept it based on bulls that don't move and rabbits that supposedly come back to life. You need extraordinary evidence. But in religion, extraordinary claims are accepted on little or no evidence. Okay, well, intelligent design is a theory that is becoming more talked about. I wouldn't even say it's a theory, it's a set of claims. And the problem is that it doesn't tell you anything. And I'm going to quote, this is kind of a long quote from a philosophical article, but I think it's very good and it's even a little bit funny. It says, the problem with the simple conclusion that something is designed, the universe, origin of life, is its lack of informativeness. If you tell me that stir knobs are designed, but nothing else about them, then how much do I actually know about stir knobs? Of a single stir knob, what can I say? Unless I already know a fair bit about the aims and intentions of stir knob designers, nothing is added to my knowledge of stir knobs by saying it's designed. I don't know if a stir knob is a good stir knob. I don't know if it's a bad stir knob. I don't know how typical that stir knob is of stir knobs in general, what any of the properties of stir knobs are. I may as well say that stir knobs are gesorptly mucknordal instead of designed, for all it tells me. But if I know the nature of the designer, or the class of things the designer is a member of, then I know something about stir knobs, and I can make inductive generalizations to the property of other stir knobs. Now, I should have said, this is addressing the claims of intelligent design, which is that we can always know whether things are designed, but we're never allowed to inquire about the nature of the designer. That's the belief of people like William Dembski. So back to, again, why aren't most scientists religious? In science, reason skepticism is prized. In religion, faith and credulity are prized. We're told you're supposed to have faith. I was told. I was raised as an Episcopalian. In science, we always look for alternative explanations. If a bull fails to stand, if it fails to continue to pull against me, I look for some alternative explanation. Maybe the bull had a stroke. Maybe the sudden explosion of sound coming from Mr. Durston's lips startled him so much. I mean, I've had dogs come right up to me and bark, and I say no, and they stop, and they're completely quiet. Maybe the same reaction. I'm looking for alternative explanations. No alternative explanations were offered by Mr. Durston. In religion, everything's explained as a result of God's providence. Bulls stop moving, it's God.
One interruption. If we could non-rebut at the moment, we'll wait till.
Okay, but you know those rules were sprung on me today, 10 minutes ago, without any prior announcement or information. So I think it's a little bit rude to announce rules that you never shared with the people who were debating. Complexity in science, complexity is explainable through natural means. That's not an issue. I mean, we know how complexity can arise. One of the mechanisms for generating complexity is the mechanism of mutation and natural selection. And this is not an issue. This is well understood. I teach about complexity in my class CS462. My TA is sitting right there. We're going to cover it in 3 weeks. Kirk, you're welcome to come, and I can explain it to you.
Thank you.
Complexity in religion is evidence of a supernatural designer. Wherever we see complexity, oh, it must be designed. So just today, in the New York Times, there was a terrific example of this contrast between religion and science. Homer Jacobson, a chemistry professor at Brooklyn College, in 1955, he published a paper called Information, Reproduction, and the Origin of Life. And he made some claims about abiogenesis. Abiogenesis is the theory that life came, arose through natural processes on the earth from an initial non-life state. So he wrote a paper in which he took issue with the then theory of abiogenesis. Now we're talking 50 years ago, so it wasn't a very detailed theory. And he made some objections. Well, this week he retracted his paper. And why? Because he discovered errors in it. He discovered that there were more potential sources of energy than he had said. And so that was a problem. He said that claims about what would have had to occur simultaneously for living matter to arise was just plain wrong. He said, it was a dumb mistake, but nobody ever caught me on it. So he retracted the paper, and he wrote, I am deeply embarrassed to have been the originator of such misstatements. And here's what the New York Times said. It's not unusual for scientists to publish papers, and if they discover evidence that challenges them, to announce they were wrong. The idea that all scientific knowledge is provisional, able to be challenged and overturned, is one thing that separates matters of science from matters of faith. So, skepticism versus faith. I've already mentioned extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. It comes from a saying of Marcel Lattruzzi, a philosopher. He says, when such claims are extraordinary, that is, revolutionary in their implications for established scientific generalizations already accumulated and verified, we must demand extraordinary proof. So that's saying, you know, when Einstein came along and threatened to overturn Newtonian mechanics, then he had to provide extraordinary proof. And that proof has been slowly provided over the last 80 years or so. It's not good enough to simply announce that E equals mc squared or time dilation, things like that. You need evidence for it. And when you're overturning a well-held theory, like Newtonian mechanics, you need lots of evidence. Religion, though, just the opposite. Blessed are those who have not seen and still have believed, according to John. And according to Martin Luther. Maybe you didn't know, Martin Luther, in addition to being a kind of despicable anti-Semite, he also said, reason is the greatest enemy that faith has. It never comes to the aid of spiritual things, but more frequently than not, struggles against the divine word, treating with contempt all that emanates from God. So, let's look at an example of how religion leads science astray. Religious thinking, magical thinking. Thinking that says that I have to explain everything through God's providence, and I'm not going to explain anything through natural means. So here is Wilbur Glenn Voliva. He said, the idea of a sun millions of miles in diameter and 91 million miles away is silly. The sun's only 32 miles across and not more than 3,000 miles from the earth. It stands to reason it must be so. God made the sun to light the earth, and therefore must have placed it close to the task it was designed to do. What would you think of a man who built a house in Zion, a town in the Midwest, and put the lamp to light it in Kenosha, another town further away? So you can see that kind of thinking, it sounds good maybe to a religious believer, right? God is a person, God wouldn't have done something so silly, therefore science is wrong. Okay, so I was going to give eight common arguments for the Christian God here, but I'm apparently not allowed to because some of them will rebut what Kirk said. So instead, I think, if you'll permit me.
If you prepared it ahead of time, I don't see a problem with that.
It's okay. I can't do it in 1 minute anyway. Instead, I'll tell you about the God that I think maybe we really should consider believing in. Ramanujan, one of the great mathematicians of all time, personal hero of mine, discovered many things, basically self-taught. Where did he get his ideas? He believed that the Hindu goddess Namagiri of Namakkal communicated mathematical results to him. It was goddess Namagiri, he would tell friends, to whom he owed his mathematical gifts. Namagiri would write equations on his tongue. Namagiri would bestow mathematical insights in his dreams. Now, Ramanujan was an incredibly successful mathematician. People were amazed by his results. Does that mean we should all believe in Namagiri now? I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Now Kirk will present his rebuttal, 10 minutes.
I'll just work my way on down through here. I find myself actually agreeing with some of what Dr. Shaw said, and others I've got to respond to. Is it? You'll have to explain why that's a miracle. I want to start off with this idea that religion stretches revelation and dogma over reason. The Bible is supreme and it's untestable and so on and so forth. Now, in a 20-minute presentation, it's hard to accurately represent the full range of religious attitudes of all sorts of different people. And so it's difficult to... I got to respond from my own perspective here. My own perspective is that if you're going to get religious about something, if the stakes are really high, let's say you're considering whether or not to put your faith in Jesus of Nazareth, the stakes are really high. There are two kinds of faith. There are the blind leap in the dark, and then there's rationally justified faith. And I know there are lots of people who take the blind leap in the dark option. But the danger of that, I think Jeffrey has pointed out here, is that a blind leap in the dark can lead you in the wrong direction. Obviously the wrong direction. And that's the danger of an irrational, blind leap in the dark faith. I personally think faith should be rationally justified, and the moment you require rational justification for your faith, then you have to start doing some investigation. Before you accept the Bible as supreme, you're going to have to come up with some rational justification for doing it, or at least rational justification to maybe justify the faith step to accept it as supreme. I would never attempt to prove the existence of God or to prove that the Bible is God's word. Proof is a very difficult thing, especially if you've gone through philosophy. It sets the bar impossibly high. What I'd like to do is just rationally justify it sufficient so that I know at least, or I'm confident that my faith is going in the right direction. So I want you to think carefully about this. There's a big difference between the faith that is a blind leap in the dark, which can lead you into all sorts of problems, some of which Dr. Shaw just pointed out, and the rationally justified faith, which will hopefully save you from going down a few wrong blind alleys. Let's talk about biblical revelation, the age of the earth, biological diversity, so forth. Again, if you're going to say that the Bible is God's word, which I agree with, there's still a problem of being cautious about what you think it's saying. For example, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, the cosmos." And it stops there. So as a scientist, I got a lot of questions here. Well, when was that? Well, it doesn't say. Now, you can assume, you can conjecture, you can speculate, and we've seen, he put up on the overhead a number of examples of what Henry Morse would say. He might be right, he might be wrong, but all I can say is I'm not going to bet the farm on how old the universe is when all it says in Genesis 1 and 2 is God creates the heavens and the earth and then stops, and the earth is with empty. So, biological diversity, for example. Now, let's take another look at that one. It says, God says, let the earth bring forth the various life forms that run around the earth. So, as a scientist, I noticed it said, let the earth bring forth. So, immediately, the question in my mind is, well, what does that mean? How did the earth bring forth the various life forms? There's a lot of questions there. I'm not going to bet the farm on stuff when there's still a lot of questions in my mind. Now, some people will make commitments and say, this is the way it is. As a scientist, I've got to be cautious, because if I see things that I can't reconcile, I'm not going to try and make the Bible fit science. I'm not going to try and science fit the Bible. What I'm going to do is I say, we've got an interesting problem here. I've got some questions. I'm going to go on a quest for knowledge here. And as a scientist, part of that quest is to say, well, what does the natural operating system permit? What can I learn about the way the world is? And just use the exact same approach a normal scientist who is an atheist would take. Once you assume the laws of nature, then suddenly you're working with the same exact tools. God did it is not a very fruitful explanation, and so that he suggests is a problem for a scientist. He's going to say, well, what causes earthquakes? Well, God did it. But I want to emphasize here that the Judeo-Christian notion, and even the ancient Hebrew notion, was that when God created the cosmos, he created a natural order of things. Very different from the Greeks. When the Greeks saw something, at least in pre-Socratic times, prior to the time of Socrates, the gods were behind everything, behind every rock and every tree and every earthquake and every volcanic eruption. So it was always the gods that were doing this and that and the other thing. But if you read the Hebrew scriptures, it's a little bit different. Let's say, for example, the disciples are out with Jesus in a boat on the Lake of Galilee, and suddenly a storm comes up. They're not saying, oh, the gods did it, we're in trouble. No, they're working hard to try and keep the boat from swamping. What they do consider a miracle is when Jesus wakes up and just with a statement stops the storm right there on the spot. Highly unusual. They consider that a miracle because it's not explainable by the natural order of things. But the natural order of things seems to be implied even throughout the Old Testament. King Solomon, for example, we are told, set his mind to try and understand the various things in nature, the plants and the animals and the way things interacted. And there's an assumption there that Solomon made 500 years, over 500 years prior to the time of Socrates and Aristotle. And the assumption that he's making here is that there's a natural order of things, there's explanations that can be searched out and found, and we have Solomon practicing the beginnings of science, as did Aristotle after the time of Socrates when he began making observations, coming up with theories and so on and so forth. So I agree with Dr. Shelley that saying God did is not a fruitful explanation. And as a scientist, the constant question in my mind is, what is explainable by the natural order of things, the natural operating system? That's what my work involves. Now, saying something is design tells us nothing, he says. And, well, maybe not. However, that seems to be a very important aspect of certain aspects of science. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, for example. We get a radio signal from deep space, and let's say it has the first 100 prime numbers. And by the criteria that perhaps Carl Sagan advanced, he's departed now, but he would have advanced, is he concludes this comes from an intelligent source. And Dr. Shelley would say, but that tells us nothing. Well, that's true, except that it comes from an intelligent source. But still, it is an important aspect of certain areas of science to determine whether something comes from an intelligent source or not. It's very important in SETI. It's very important in forensic science. It's very important in archaeology. So we see the Sphinx, for example. Somebody says, well, what caused that? I'd say, I think that's a product of an intelligent agent at some point in the past. Well, that tells us nothing, Dr. Shelley might say. Well, yeah, okay, it tells us nothing, but maybe it's a product of intelligent design, but it's still a conclusion we can arrive by looking at the natural system. And in general, the underlying hypothesis here is that anything that's capable of producing significant amounts of functional or meaningful information is probably from an intelligent source based on our empirical observations that intelligent agents can do stuff like that. And based on our observations of the natural operating system, the natural operating system cannot seem to do stuff like that. So I would say that question still is a valid question in science. Is it designed? Is the algorithmic complexity in the genome, is that designed or not? Well, let's say it is, just for the sake of argument. Does science stop? Of course not. So the next question is, well, then how did the designer do it? What does it teach us about the designer? And more importantly, perhaps for the average person in the lab, is what can we now do with the information encoded in the genome, now that we've resolved that other question, if we haven't resolved it. Regarding the goal and alternative explanations, of course, difficult to defend. All I observe as a person who spent years working with cattle is that when you have a 2,000-pound animal making movements like he's straining against the rope, I don't think he's having a stroke, it's not like he's standing there. Is straining against it. That rope is so tight you can play a tune on it. Something is restraining that rope, and I can't take responsibility for the tension in this rope here. The pulses in the rope as the bull heaves against the rope. Something is going on, highly unusual. But you can say it was a stroke, highly unlikely. It really works for the person who actually witnesses it. And this is where sometimes witnessing these things carries a lot more weight than just hearing about it. Complexity. There's different kinds of complexity. There's random sequence complexity, ordered sequence complexity, algorithmic complexity. And nature can certainly produce random complexity, ordered complexity. It's the algorithmic complexity that is the problem. Martin Luther claims that reason is the greatest enemy that faith has. I would certainly disagree with Martin Luther. My own view is that if God exists, and he gave me a mind, I'm expected to use it. And if my reason conflicts with faith, I got a problem. There's some rational problem there. See, the stop sign is up, so I'll have to close there.
Thanks very much, Kirk. At this time, Jeffrey will deliver his rebuttal. 10 minutes.
Okay, well, my opponent gave a bunch of problems that he sees with scientific explanations for various things. And he actually gave a fair number of it, and now I have my 10 minutes to respond. It's not going to be easy to get responses to everything. I do have responses to every single point, I believe. I took them down. And if you'd like to ask questions in the question period for anything I didn't address, please do so. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to say that you misrepresented a lot of the evidence that you've claimed. So let's start off with Hilbert. Your claim was specifically that Hilbert proved that an infinite regress of causes was impossible. You said the mathematics demands it. Well, I have this paper of Hilbert that you referred to here, David Hilbert on the infinite. You can come up, anyone in the audience can come up and look at it afterwards. There's no proof in there, sorry. You've been fooled by William Lane Craig, who's not exactly the most reliable source. He's a Christian apologist. There's no proof in here. This article was written in 1925. What Hilbert was talking about was the then understanding of the physical universe, the then current 1925, 82 years ago, understanding of the model of the universe. He said, in that understanding, there's no infinite quantities in the universe. But this is 2007. We've learned a heck of a lot about the universe since then. And, you know, I'm not a physicist, but my physicist colleagues assure me that there are very respectable physical theories in which, in fact, there are infinite quantities in nature. So, let's see if I can find the slide for that. Yeah, so here it is. In fact, I would assert that there is no logical reason to rule out an infinite regress of causes. We could have a singularity at time zero and an event at time 1 over n plus 1 causing an event at time 1 over n for all n. So we have an event at time of fourth that causes an event at time of third, an event at time of fifth that caused that event at time of fourth, and so forth. You get an infinite regress of causes. This is actually very similar to some of the claims made about the singularity of the Big Bang, that there are an infinite number of states after the singularity of the Big Bang. So in fact, there's no logical reason, and please don't believe him when he said Hilbert proved that he didn't do anything. So that's misrepresentation number one. Misrepresentation number two. There's no reason to believe that causality is preserved at the Big Bang singularity. I mean, causality is something that we understand in macro states. If I hit this microphone, it'll make a noise. I caused it. That's understandable. But at very, very large scales, or very, very small scales, our physical intuition vanishes. When we approach the speed of light, we get all sorts of relativistic effects that we don't experience at normal everyday speeds. That doesn't mean they don't happen. We verify them. It means our physical intuition, which has been honed by evolution to go no more than about 20 or 30 kilometers an hour, is very poor for the giant, the fast, the tiny. And in particular, I'll give you an example about causality being violated. I have here a scintillation counter. It measures the decay of radioactive particles. I have here in my other hand a sample of uraninite, a uranium ore. I turn on the scintillation counter, and what do you hear? You hear the decay of radioactive particles. This sample of uraninite began to decay during the formation of the solar system. It was forged in a supernova 4.6 billion years ago or earlier, and it began to decay during the formation of the solar system. About half of it has now decayed to lead. But if I point to any individual uranium atom in this sample, don't worry, you're safe in the front row. And I already had a couple of kids. if you point to any individual uranium atom in here and you say, is that atom going to decay in the next 5 minutes? You can't know. There's no causality or determinism there. You can't say, yeah, that's the atom that's going to do it. And when you observe an atom decaying or listen to it decaying, you can't say, well, what caused that atom as opposed to some other atom decaying? So we see, just in the phenomenon of radioactivity, that our normal notions of causality and determinism are violated. Now, let's get to probably the most effective point that you made, the origin of life. And I'm afraid to say there's a lot of misrepresentation there, too. So let me first concede the origin of life is an enormously difficult scientific problem. We're trying to reconstruct exactly what happened 3.5 billion years ago on the Earth. But significant scientific progress has been made here. For example, the RNA world hypothesis. It's called a hypothesis because it's not a theory yet. There's not a huge amount of supporting evidence, but there is some. There's Karen Smith's clay hypothesis. Nevertheless, despite this progress, an enormous amount of nonsense has been written by creationists about the origin of life. Probability calculation, the last refuge of scoundrels. Creationists, like my opponent, use unrealistic models, event probabilities out of thin air, calculate an enormously small probability, and say, God did it. He claimed we needed 150 genes for the smallest living thing, 150 proteins. But the first living thing was not a cell, almost certainly. No person who studies abiogenesis, and I know some of them, thinks the first living thing was a cell. This is preposterous. There's no reason to believe the first replicator was based on DNA. It could have been based on RNA, for example. Now look, here's a slide from the Talk.Origins website, written by Ian Musgrave, a colleague of mine, called Lies, Damned Lies, Statistics and the Probability of Abiogenesis Calculations, and it's accurate. On the left, we have the creationist idea. Simple chemicals, suddenly bacteria, cells. No, the real theory is much more complicated. Simple chemicals gave rise to polymers. Polymers gave rise to replicating polymers. Replicating polymers gave rise to hypercycles. Hypercycles gave rise to protobiomes. And then, after a long series of steps not shown, we got to bacteria. Now, do we have detailed transitions for everything? No, but we have a general outline that we can work with. Life's building blocks occur naturally. So I'll go through this real quickly. Complex organic molecules are relatively widespread. Molecules other than proteins, he said, had to be proteins. They can have biologically relevant activity. Molecules with specific activities can be isolated from randomly generated libraries. He talked about libraries, but we can get it from small libraries. Ribozymes and simple protein enzymes can arise spontaneously. Now let's look at what actual origin of life researchers say. So this is from the book Scientists Confront Creationism. I recommend it. It's an excellent book. It was written 25 years ago, but it's still relevant. The next time you hear creationists railing about the impossibility of making a particular protein, isn't that what he did? This book was written, let's see, what did I say? 1983, sorry. It was written 24 years ago. I guess you didn't learn. Whether hemoglobin or ribonuclease or cytochrome C, you can smile wryly and know they are nowhere near consideration of the real issues. So I see this as a God of the Gaps fallacy. Let's go past that. And here. Now, what I want to finish with is the discussion of Douglas Axe. So this is really important. This is probably my most important point. So he gave an argument saying that proteins that actually accomplish something, that have a functional property, are very thinly distributed. We can't possibly generate them through random means, and we can't possibly generate them through random selection. But if you look at Axe's paper, that's not what's going on. He was trying to estimate the distribution of functional proteins in sequence space, but he didn't work with a typical functional protein. He didn't use a native penicillinase, but a variant that had lower activity than normal. Then he picked a variant that was very sensitive to mutations, of course. It's not going to be active, again, once you mutate it. His choice doesn't model the behavior of a normal enzyme, and he excluded other structures that could have given the same functional activity. Now, are you familiar with the recent paper of Meyer and Jensen? Well, I think you should read it, and I brought a copy for you here. What Meyer and Jensen showed is that Axe's idea are totally wrong. There are small islands of functional activity that are connected by bridges. Now look, in evolution, somebody who supports evolution would say, look, we don't know how proteins evolve, but we know that they can't be as improbable as Mr. Durston says. We know there must be some other mechanism because we've seen evolution happen. What could that other mechanism do? What could it be? That's what Meyer and Jensen, 10 seconds, that's what Meyer and Jensen did in this paper, and they found what Mr. Durston said can't happen. They found those bridges. Connecting different functional proteins. So I think you'll enjoy reading that.
Thank you.
I now invite Kirk for his 5-minute closing remarks.
Okay, 5 minutes is not very long to do what I need to do here. First, regarding Hilbert, you pulled a mathematical trick there. Those of you who are used to some summing infinite series will know that if the x decreases exponentially, it comes to a finite value. So let me explain how this really works. Let's assume, now I don't know whether he's saying that. Has he dodged the issue here as to whether or not the past is infinite or not? So let's assume the past is infinite. So let's call this debate time zero. This hour here, the debate is time zero. The next hour after this will be time zero plus one. Time two and so forth. And in the past, we'll go to the last hour before this debate will be negative one hour, negative two and so forth. Now, if you want to assume, and this is to illustrate why there's a problem traversing an actual infinite series in reality. Let's say that there's each step in the series is 1 hour long. Now, what he seems to be arguing, or what he's insisting here, I'm not sure, is that the past can be infinite. That is, there's an actual hour infinitely separated from this one here. So let's call that minus infinity. We'll never get there by getting in a time machine going back. So let's just take a quantum leap back into the past. We're now at minus infinity. Now, some of those of you who are familiar with infinite set theory might be a little uncomfortable at this point. Because if the past is, if you're saying it actually is infinite, there actually is, what you mean is there actually is an hour back there that is infinitely separated from this one. So let's count our way down now. Infinity minus one, infinity minus two. It's 1 hour each, not an exponentially decreasing amount of time like that little equation you put up there, but just a steady hour each time. Or you can go with a multi-universe. This universe is a product of another universe. We're working our way down from minus infinity to the present. At what point in time will you arrive at zero? You will never traverse an infinite series in reality if you must stop at a discrete amount of time for a constant amount of time in between. And that pretty much lays to rest this notion that time itself can be infinite as far as the past goes. It can be potentially infinite. You can do lots of mathematical things. I can fold my hands together and say there's an infinite number of mathematical points. No problem. Those are imaginary. But the moment you have a discrete amount that occupies a discrete amount of time, like a minute or a second or an hour, and it is not decreasing, then suddenly you have a problem if you want to actually traverse that infinite series in reality. Radioisotope decay is an example of violation of causality. That is simply an assertion. I would recommend you read J.S. Bell's Speakable and Unspeakable. Last chapter, where he talks about six views of quantum mechanic reality. Weinberg addresses this as well. My view of quantum mechanics is that the wave function actually evolves in a deterministic fashion. And radioisotope decay is controlled by the wave function. and therefore it's not a violation of the causal principle. In fact, we even get clues of that because there are equations that tell you what the probability of that decay will be, and they are repeatable. They don't change over time. We know something is operating there, and simply because we don't know what the cause is, we don't toss the causal principle out the window, which seems what Dr. Shelton wants to do. When faced with a conclusion he doesn't want to address, he's willing to abandon the causal principle on which all of science is based. I'm arguing that it's even operable at the quantum level, if the wave function evolves in a deterministic fashion. First living cell. Let's get to this problem. He never addressed how we're going to get these proteins. We know they exist today. He has possibly one paper that I haven't read yet that probably does an experiment between, I don't know what, two proteins in the same protein family? Were they both in the same protein family?
Why are they separated?
Well, I'll have to read that paper. It is possible that you will have not a uniform distribution of protein, stable folding proteins in sequence space, so that some may be close, but if you have some close, you'll have to make up if it's going to be uniform distribution or average distribution, there'll be some that are much further apart. But in general, I've developed a method to actually quantify, and that's what I like to do here, is to quantify the distance between two different proteins. And he had the advantage of listening to my debate last night at McMaster, so he's a little more well-prepared than I am. And I'm just making it up on the fly here. I'd like to see that paper ahead of time, but I can guarantee you, based on my work already, is that you do not have to take Axe's word for that. You can download line sequences for any protein family you want. And there is a method published in my first paper that will measure the distance from that. You can bridge that gap in the lab, and that's often done. I know of other examples where the gap is bridged in the lab. But it's gap through an intelligent intervention. What you need to do is to be able to bridge that gap with a completely natural scenario. He mentioned a number of scenarios there. The fundamental problem of every one of them is not producing some sort of system there that has order to it. The fundamental problem is getting the functional information into the system that's going to code for proteins. They exist today. You can't deny it. Somehow, he has to come up with an explanation as to how we're going to get these protein families.
I now invite Jeffrey for his 5-minute closing remark.
Friends, we live in exciting and dangerous times. Exciting because today we understand so much more about the world than we ever have before. We live in an immense cosmos that's 13.7 billion years old, I feel like Carl Sagan. A cosmos that's made up of an enormous number of fundamental particles. The particles come together to form about 100 chemical elements that make up everything in this room and everything in your bodies. We live in a solar system that came into being from the ashes of dead stars 4.54 billion years ago. Earth, our home, orbits a sun that warms us through the reactions of nuclear fusion. The sun is a mass of incandescent gas. And will continue to do so for billions of years. All life is intimately related. Isn't that great? Having descended from a single life form that arose about 3 billion years ago. We and the apes share a common ancestor that lived in Africa about 5 million years ago. All people are truly brothers and sisters, sharing the same genetic heritage. Now we know these things. How do we know them? We know them not because of prayer or religious revelation, or sacred texts, or meditation, or sacrificing of goats, or altered states of consciousness. We know these because generations of scientists weren't afraid to question the dogmas of previous generations, sometimes losing their lives or their liberty in the process. Our scientific picture of the universe is now far grander and subtler than anything conceived by the authors of the Old Testament, the New Testament, or the Quran. And there's so much more waiting to be discovered. But we live in dangerous times, too. We're now confronted with threats more serious than ever before. The threat of global climate change, bringing significant disruption to our lives, hangs over us. The plague of AIDS threatens to wipe out the entire continent of Africa. Nuclear proliferation brings the specter of mass destruction, or a dirty bomb that could render a major city unlivable for hundreds or thousands of years. Faced with these threats, what does fundamentalist religion really offer us? My opponent offers the absurd and grotesque image of the supposed creator of the universe, the inventor of everything that ever was or will be, unwilling to aid us with these threats, these significant threats to our survival, but ready to subdue aggressive bulls or bring rabbits back to life for the cost of a brief prayer. The fundamentalist God is one that is obsessively and intrusively concerned with our sex lives, but apparently unwilling to allow us to perform experiments on stem cells to make life better for sufferers of disease. I am a provisional non-theist, someone who has not yet been convinced by the arguments for the existence of gods, of Christians, Jews, or Muslims. But I'm not the enemy of theists. On the contrary, if yours is a theism that is willing to acknowledge that your conception of God might be wrong, that your belief in a supreme being doesn't create any obligation on the part of non-believers, that your holy books are human artifacts that may be read metaphorically or might contain errors, that we should behave charitably toward our fellow humans because it's the right thing to do and not because of threats of eternal torment, then you are my brothers and sisters. Let us go and solve our problems by reasoning together without relying on the dogmas of past ages. But if your sect is the enemy of rationalism, if it requires that evolution be false or homosexuals be stoned or shunned or forbidden to teach elementary school or adopt children, if you agree with Martin Luther that a lie that serves the church is ethically acceptable, or as my opponent admitted here at the University of Waterloo, just a few months ago, that genocide is perfectly okay if God does it, and it's okay to kill me and everybody in this room if God told him to do it, and he said he would do it if God told him to, and he was sure, then you're part of the problem, not part of the solution. So the question is, will we remain children, consoled by the false promises of fundamentalist religion, slavishly adhering to dogma, blindly following the prejudice and bigotry of past ages, or will we go forward together as adults to stand on our own, ready to face the future with reason and courage? Let's all pray we make the right choice.
Thank you both very much. This concludes the formal debate.